Believe it or not, of course, we all have entertainment attorneys in some way, shape, or form. And I get this email from him, and he says, you've got to read this. You'll probably be crazy enough to go. And, of course, it said, Raspberries reunited in Cleveland. So that Sunday morning at 10 a.m., just on a whim, and I underline on a whim, I bought two $40 tickets, and I figured the worst thing I'd do is sell them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as time went on, by the time I finished calling the House of Blues, and they said, oh, we'll get you interviews, and, you know, I called the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they've given me their radio studio for a while, I thought, so anyway, I'm coming to Cleveland. In 1972, this song called Go All the Way came blasting out of my AM radio, courtesy of WABC in New York, and I was 15 at the time.
Cool.
But I was doing a top 25 show on cable radio, and since no one told me what to do back then, I immediately made it number one on my chart.
Thank you very much.
But more importantly, I think I was a little more innocent back then. I didn't really know what the song was about, maybe. And it was a song about making love wrapped in such an incredible, you know, piece of rock and roll candy.
Mm-hmm.
Did stations think twice about the subject matter of this song?
Did I?
Did the radio stations?
I intended it to do exactly what happened to you. You say, well, the genesis of the song was that, you know, having been a kid and fan myself, I grew up watching the Rolling Stones on the Ed Sullivan Show having to sing Let's Spend Some Time Together.
Right.
And at the same time, I was a huge Beach Boys fan, listening to Brian Wilson getting away with murder because they sang pretty. And it occurred to me that in order to, you know, part of the fun of that era of songwriting was that you had to put things sort of a bit, sort of disguise things a bit, or you didn't get it on the radio. So I decided to write a song, and instead of having the guy say it to the girl, you know, please, let's go all the way, I thought, well, I'll put it in her mouth, and we'll sing it sweetly, and we'll see if we can slide it by radio. And lo and behold, it worked. I figured one of two things would happen. It would either have to be a top 10 record just because, you know, it was the whole kind of purpose of it. So I was thrilled. You know, I was probably just driving down the street. And it was probably so exciting that I forgot where I was.
Undoubtedly. Whose idea was the sticker on the album? I still have my original from 1972, and
Capitol
it's still...
Capitol Art Department.
It still smells.
We had nothing to do with it.
Do you know that 1972, it still smells?
I know it does. It's pretty crazy.
That was powerful stuff.
No, the way we actually heard about it is that... I remember Dave, our bass player, calling me one night about 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, and he said, I just got the weirdest call of this girl. This shows you how in the loop they kept us, you know, with the whole thing. He said, this girl just called me, and she said, I bought your album. And I said to her, what do you mean you bought our album? Our album's not out yet. And she goes, oh, yes, it is. And she said, well, actually, I didn't buy the... He said, well, what's on it? If you have it, then tell me the songs on it. And she read him the songs. And he said, oh, my God, that's unbelievable. How could you have our album? And we didn't even know it's out. She said, well, it actually isn't the album. It's the 8-track. They said the album was being held up for a couple of days because when you squeeze it, like raspberry jam is going to fall out or something.
Oh, no.
And that's what we heard. And he calls me in a panic saying, what is this? What is this? Raspberry jam is going to fall out of our album or something? And we, of course, got on the phone the next day and called and found out about this scratch and sniff sticker, which we were not sure we liked.
Yeah, no. But hey, it became a collectible, so that's
kind of
cool.
But it was already done, and I guess it's been a kind of a conversation thing over the these many years.
So you're back together with the band after 30 years for this opening of the Cleveland House of Blues.
32.
Oh my goodness.
32 years since we last played together.
Wow. How much have you been rehearsing, and what's changed? I mean, the band members have kept in touch.
Yes. Well, you know, off and on. Jim Bonfanti, the drummer, and I basically formed the band together in 1970. And he and I have stayed in touch over all these years. He's just a darn good guy. And when we had discussed at various junctures, you know, people had suggested that we, you know, had a reunion and whatever. And for various and sundry reasons, you know, Wally and I weren't getting along, or, you know, Dave and Wally weren't getting along or something or whatever, or somebody was doing something else. It never happened, but one of the big reasons why it never happened was that I've been a stickler, having, you know, kind of continued in the music business and seen what a good date can be. There are so many things that go into the production of one of these sorts of shows that have nothing whatsoever to do with the band itself. It's not just playing the songs. It's, you know, if you get on stage and the sound system is awful, or your sound man doesn't know what he's doing, nobody walks out of there and says, oh, gee, their sound man was an idiot. They walk out and they say the band sucked. Nobody sits down and wants to figure out or cares to figure out, you know, what was wrong with it. It's just the band sucked. And so there's a, you know, if you're going to do one of these things, as far as I was concerned, you know, there's a certain myth that's grown up around the band. And I never wanted to be the guy to pop the bubble, you know, put us on a stage and have people walk out of the room and say, oh, they weren't so great. So if we were ever to do this, we had to do it in a way that we could control the production values. And that requires either a lot of money or a situation that arises where some of those things are just taken care of. And this House of Blues date was exactly that. When I was out with Ringo Starr in 2000 on the with the Ringo's All-Star Tour, we played the House of Blues in Chicago, and we did a couple of nights at the House of Blues in Los Angeles, and I was just knocked out with what great clubs they were. I said this a number of times, and then I actually saw an interview with Dan Aykroyd where he was talking about how, well, he did this on purpose, but it's the first time I've ever been in a club that really looks like it was engineered from the ground up for the musicians, you know, and for their audience. It's, you know, there's just not a bad seat anywhere. The sight lines are great from wherever you are to the stage. It's an intimate room that holds 1,200 people somehow, and they're just you know, there's a great sound system, great lighting system already there. And so when this came up, and they called us, Jim and I talked, and I said, you know, if ever we were going to do this, this would be the place to do it, because it eliminates so many of the hassles and problems that we'd have to otherwise deal with coming up with production. And so it was on that basis that we started to talk to them, and they've just been, you know, I got to say that it's been a dreamy experience. They're great people to work with. And as you know, after this show sold out in 4 minutes, they said, let's talk about doing another show. And then just last Friday, they announced New Year's Eve. It's all of a sudden gotten mushroomed into something much bigger.
Out of control in a good
way.
It's
out of control, yes. And in terms of stuff that's different now, I think everybody's had 30 years plus to put their past grievances away and you know, say, okay, and to think about the stuff that we all did as hot-headed 23-year-olds that we probably wouldn't do again today. And beyond that, the technology is just so much better for everything. I mean, you know, when I went out looking for keyboards, I remember what I used to use in the Raspberries. And I mean, at some point early in our, you know, early in the procedure, I mean, we used to, there was no such thing as a great electric piano. So, I mean, I had to go out and nail a guitar pickup onto an upright piano, and we had to haul that around with us. And now, I mean, I sit down and, you know, they're the most fantastic sounding keyboards imaginable. And that sort of thing is gone with everything, with amplifiers and with guitars and everything else. So, I mean, it's just easier to sound really good now. And we rehearsed last night, and it sounds really good.
Yeah, I cannot wait. Why do you think industrial cities like Cleveland and Liverpool, now there's an interesting combination for you, breed such powerful rock and roll?
I don't know. I had a theory about this years ago, which is that, you know, there's nothing else to do.
There you go. The river's on fire. Might as well play some rock and roll.
I mean, you know, in some ways, Liverpool and Cleveland are very similar.
Just a little bit of revisionist history, and a lot of people can find this on your website, but for those who you know, don't take the time, At age 3, you were taking a class at the Cleveland Institute of Music, and then you took violin lessons from your Aunt Muriel. So you were on your way to being the next Henry Mancini or Burt Bacharach, but then kind of the Beatles and Stones kind of turned your course to rock and roll, although the classical did come back big time in the later years.
Uh-huh. That's all true.
So do you want to still, would you like to not go back to being Henry Mancini or Burt Bacharach?
Well, you know, certainly nothing wrong with being Burt Bacharach. I still think he's one of the, you know, best. He was still one of my biggest influences, you know, from the guys in the 60s. I was always just a fan of great songwriting. And, you know, before the Beatles, the songs that were being played on pop radio were, you know, Itsy Bitsy, Teeny Weeny, Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, you know, and that sort of stuff. And so I wasn't a huge fan of that stuff. And then when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones happened, I started to, like, pay a little more attention. I was like, well, wait a minute, this actually might be a song here. And, but, you know, during that whole 60s, I mean, it was, for me, my continuing education was Burt Bacharach, Brian Wilson, and Lennon McCartney. Guys, they were the best.
Absolutely.
And that's what I listened to. And I, you know, really would credit between my classical training and then listening to that stuff, doses of Pete Townsend and Jagger and Richards as well. You know, that's my formal training.
Not a bad way to go by any stretch. Tell me, this might be the same as the Capitol Records story, but tell me about the relationship with Jimmy, your producer, Jimmy Iovine. Did he execute your vision? How much of the sound was his, since, you know, the producer, as we know, would say a Phil Spector on Let It Be can affect the final sound in a positive or a negative way.
Uh-huh.
But you have a long-term relationship with him. You brought him, you know, into the solo album way beyond the Raspberries.
Uh-huh. Well, Jimmy, first of all, Jimmy's just, he's a great, big, lovable, warm, fuzzy, wonderful guy.
As opposed to that other man.
Who is, you know, I'd compare him to Bill Clinton. He'll just charm your pants off. He's a kind of a larger-than-life character, and he sort of discovered us. And so, you know, he was an integral part of all those early records. And, you know, it wasn't so much, you know, I mean, he wasn't a Phil Spector kind of guy. You know, the band wrote their own songs, and you know, Phil Spector, you know, pretty much was the guy who was the songwriter, creative wizard, and producer all wrapped up in one. And he kind of brought the songs in and could have lined up, you know, anybody to sing them. In our case, we sang and we played and we wrote the songs and we pretty much arranged the tunes. So it was a different kind of thing, which was just trying to get our sound onto the record. And in the early records, you know, I don't think we were that good in the studio. It was a brand new experience. We were young kids. And then as we got better, I think everything got better. So, but, it, you know, Jimmy was a great guy, and we had a great relationship, and we still do. You know, when we were going to do this thing, one of the first calls I made was, you know, just to let Jimmy know in case he was going to be around, in case he wanted to pop up and see us.
So in 1974, you kind of pulled out one last album, which was Starting All Over, and mm-hmm. Overnight Sensation hit record, and a lot of people know who they listen to my show. I've explained the fact that you wanted it to be called Hit Record, and the record company wanted Overnight
exactly.
Sensation.
Mm-hmm.
But what is amazing to me is that that went to number 18 on the charts.
And yet no one's ever heard it.
And well, but it was such an it was a really long record, over 5 minutes. But the production, the phasing, and the section near the end where things get quiet and mm-hmm. then come back and all of that, it is amazing to me that that did, you know, go as far as it did.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever release a single? Did they ever try to cut a version of it?
I don't think so. With Overnight Sensation, you know, I saw the whole song sort of as a little movie in my head. And very sort of visually oriented, and then just tried to recreate that on the record. And there just wouldn't have been a lot. If you cut anything out of there, it just wouldn't have had the same impact. So
every time I play that record, the first thing that happens is the phone rings and someone says, "Who is that?" And the guesses are amazing, but even more so, you know, and this will kind of get into some of the obvious stuff, but the influence that that song did have on musicians and rock and roll, you know, I don't think I can possibly hear some Queen songs or God knows what else without immediately thinking, you know, of Overnight Sensation.
I heard that the Buggles were pretty influenced by that when they did Video Killed the Radio Star.
Oh, I would see that as being highly, highly likely. So, somewhere in an interview, I read that your advice to young songwriters was to hold on to your publishing rights, as so many in the 50s and 60s didn't. You know,
it's hard to do in the music business.
Did you do
it's
it?
Very important.
But you did it.
Well, I held on to part of it initially, and then I had a very long, nasty lawsuit against my publisher that took about 8 years, and
ouch.
Eventually, I got them all back.
Terrific.
And
that's very important with several songs, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, with one, at least one in particular, possibly a couple.
Yeah, a number of them, actually.
Yes.
And so that was, you know, it was the kind of the best thing that ever happened, is that I got them back, and then Celine went and recorded All By Myself, which sold like 30 million copies.
Not a bad deal.
Life was good.
Not a bad deal.
Mm-hmm.
The obvious question, because it gets bandied about, and yet I don't think it's possible to ever do a radio station on this, although I certainly do a lot of it. What the heck is power pop?
You know, I think Pete Townsend coined the word, or coined the phrase, to describe the Who's music. And I think what he was talking about is it's a song, a well-constructed song with a melody that also is powerful. And, you know, I certainly would look back at the Who's stuff and say they were, you know, original progenitors of power pop, and they were obviously a huge influence on us, you know, prior to the Raspberries. I played in a band called Cyrus Erie, and we did a 14-song Who medley, including, you know, hard-to-find album cuts and, you know, things that were on the back of British 45s, and, you know, songs like I'm a Boy and, you know, everything from Can't Explain to The Kids Are All Right to Pictures of Lily to, you know, The Good's Gone. I mean, just odd, crazy songs and things that were album tracks. And we absolutely loved The Who. And I always loved that Pete Townsend kind of came at songwriting as, you know, this very sort of, he thought of it very orchestrally. I mean, his guitar, if you listen to the end of Won't Get Fooled Again, is exactly what you hear at the end of symphonies. Dun, 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 ba-da-dum. You know, it's, you know, having grown up with classical music, I understood what he was doing. He was just doing it with a guitar instead of a 50-piece orchestra. But,
And no, you know, one would ever say that. It's interesting, because if you put the Raspberries next to the Who, no one would ever consider them in the same genre, and yet it is very true.
Well, you know, I mean, if you go back and actually even listen to the Raspberries Starting Over album, there's a song I wrote on there that was sort of a pastiche of every Who song ever written that I liked, called I Don't Know What I Want. And you know, it was funny. I was talking to one of my guys is interesting on this show. Not only did we get the entire four original Raspberries back, we also got our entire original road crew, who have flown in from all over the country to say, we couldn't miss this, we have to be part of this. And one of them is a guy named Kevin Dugan, who is just the greatest guy in the world. And he's been a roadie for Van Halen for the last 20 years or so. And before that, worked for with a bunch of heavy metal bands in Los Angeles, and he had an interview he heard with Roger Daltrey, where he was listening to the interview, and at some point, the guy put on this record and started to play. Stop him and say, "Well, you know that record isn't us." And the guy said, was like, "What do you mean it's not you?" And it was, I don't know what I want.
That's amazing.
I thought that was pretty funny.
So I could go through a whole pile of questions about the solo career, but for me the two most interesting songs are not necessarily All By Myself or Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. Actually, there are three that are of interest to me, And that is That's Rock and Roll, Sunrise.
Interesting.
And Boats Against the Current. And the reason I say that is because That's Rock and Roll, you know, again, you put that on, you play that, and the phone rings within seconds, and somebody says, what year was that from, and what is that? I mean, you know, you couldn't have found a more powerful way to start an album. But then you kind of went to Boats Against the Current, and I think, if I remember reading correctly, you know, fans were kind of, it was a very sophisticated, concept-y kind of thinking song, as opposed to a Sunrise or That's Rock and Roll.
Yeah, it wasn't an obvious, I know, you know, my comparison would be if when you see the title All By Myself, you know just what that song is about, and you know what's going to be inside that, you know, when you put it on, you know what it's going to be talking about. When you see the title Boats Against the Current, you don't really know what that's going to be about. And it was a whole, you know, a much more cerebral record. And
hard for people
yeah,
to take
not
on.
As not as easily digested, to be sure. And you know, it was just kind of where I was at that point. I think I had, while I was in the process of writing that album, I was reading everything that F. Scott Fitzgerald ever wrote, and I think his prose style influenced my lyric style writing these things. And I was also, he's a very depressed guy. I think I was pretty depressed when I was writing that stuff, and it just you know, it's you don't really plan these things sometimes. It just kind of came out that way. And I'm very proud of that album. I wished that if I could go back in time, that the head of FM promotion at Arista Records had not left the company 2 weeks before the album came out. That didn't really help things.
Might have been able to do something with it.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of the first time I'd ever made an album that wasn't just a collection of singles, and it was, you know, my bid for some sort of maybe FM credibility. It was a very inopportune time for that guy to have left the label, and they basically didn't replace him for the whole time that my album was out. It's one of those things that just happens in the business, and
you just kind of look back on it. But I mean, in the 80s, you really did persevere big time with, you know, Hungry Eyes and Make Me Lose Control, and really, these became very, very powerful songs, you know, on a movie that was kind of an iconic film.
It's true.
So tell me a little bit about your last decade of rock and roll, kind of the 90s into the 2000s, because, and I'll circle back to this, but I know that you kind of stopped songwriting a while, Nick, due to a gentleman named Clive Davis.
Well, you know, I don't want to blame Clive for this. I just, you know, at a certain moment in time, I think there were a lot of different things going on. One of them was that, you know, I had been at Arista for a long time. I had submitted some things to Clive. He wasn't nuts about them. Clive has a very specific type of taste. And if you stray from that, you can pretty much bet that he's not going to love it. So, you know, unless you are really willing to do that thing that Clive loves, you're not going to really be too terribly successful there. And I think we had reached a point where Clive was thinking, you know, maybe Eric should do some songs by other people, because the stuff he's writing is not, you know, not hitting me that hard. And I was distraught at the idea that, you know, why would I be doing songs written by other people? I'd become good friends with Diane Warren, whose stuff I did like. You know, we're going to try to do something together, and we did some demos, and one of them sort of became a record, and I don't know, it was very confusing. And I think right about the same time, Clive sort of said, this isn't working, and I said, this isn't working. And we said mutually, let's cut this out. And so for a while there, I just didn't do anything. I came back home, and I sat around, and I said, do I want to do this anymore? It had gotten kind of tedious, and I think if you talk to most musicians, they will tell you that the music part is really fun. The business side of the music business is not much fun and can be very, very limiting and very difficult. And you know, every so often a group comes along that is wildly successful, and they kind of circumvent all that stuff that ends up going on. But, you know, if you are not initially wildly successful, you get embroiled in it, and it affects what you do, and it becomes crazy. So I just quit doing it for a while, and then I went back and, you know, thought I would start to write some things again, and I, you know. And then right around that time, my children came along. I got married in 1993, and in 1997, my son was born. And everybody that I knew who had grown up children by now said to me when my son was born, boy, cherish these early years. They just go by in a snap.
Indeed.
And when he was born, I realized that, boy, this is the most fun I've ever had. I love being a dad. I love being his dad. And I couldn't imagine wanting to be away from him. And the one time that I left was to go out with Ringo, because you don't often get to, you know, play with a Beatle. And our bass player was Jack Bruce from Cream, so that was pretty cool too. And Dave Edmonds on guitar, and Simon Kirk from Freon on drums. Not a bad band, and I thought, well, I kind of have to do this.
Are there bands that you think have done a pretty good job of keeping this power pop rock and roll music alive?
Boy, that's a darn interesting question. You know, I haven't really listened to a whole lot of this new music. Every now and then I'll see or hear a record that I like. Like, I like Michelle Branch.
Mm-hmm.
I like Fountains of Wayne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're very cool.
You know, and here and there, there are little things. You know, I heard, was it The Laws?
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed. But
and The Laws made one album.
I just keep waiting for, you know, one of these deals where somebody will come out of nowhere, four young kids that actually can write, and change the landscape. That's what I'm waiting for, because as soon as you know, one act comes along that breaks through and is really successful, then every record label will drop all their rap acts for the moment and say, go to their A&R people, go get me one of those, and you know, and maybe, you know, there will be something to listen to on the radio again.
What a concept. Which leads me to the last thing that I always do, and it's become a trademark and it works out really fun. What I'd like you to do, and totally off the top of your head,
mm-hmm.
is to make me a raspberries sandwich, where two raspberry songs are the bread,
okay,
and then you can fill it with any ingredients you would like, and then I do play that set exactly as you have asked for, and we've come up with some amazing, amazing things.
A raspberry sandwich.
So you pick
okay.
two of your songs as the bread, and then you can pull anything from any genre or any time whatsoever, as many songs as you would want.
Raspberry songs.
Well,
or anybody's song.
Raspberry songs as the bread. So two
oh, okay.
raspberry songs as the bread. And
okay.
then the middle is anything that you've always kind of wanted to hear next to your music on the radio.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah, it's pretty joyful stuff.
This
I enjoy
is,
putting it
cool.
together.
All right, raspberry songs as the bread. Well, the only problem is picking which two.
And by the way, people cheat. Sometimes what they do is they do a club sandwich.
A club sandwich.
They've been
okay.
known to do
get
that.
An extra slice of bread in the middle.
Indeed.
Okay. That'll work for me. Why don't we, now is this supposed to be kind of an eclectic thing, or, I mean,
it could be,
well,
you know,
I could say go all the way, which, you know, it's fairly obvious, but, you know, or I could pick something much, you know, more like,
you can go whatever way, whatever you would like to hear, because you said, you know, it'd be nice to hear something on the radio that you actually like, so I will get you a copy of this set.
Okay. Well, then, in that case, let's the top slice will be tonight.
Excellent.
And then, you know, in between there, we could put I Can't Explain by The Who, Tin Soldier by The Small Faces, Ticket to Ride by The Beatles, maybe Overnight Sensation as the other slice of bread, maybe I'm Only Dreaming by The Small Faces.
All right.
Or, oh, here, I better one. How about Afterglow by The Small Faces?
Excellent.
Our Love Was / Is by The Who.
Cool.
And we can close out with Ecstasy.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Eric.
I look forward to meeting you, Dennis.
That'll be terrific.
All right.
Have a good evening.